Good evening. As you know from the title of this evening's lecture, it's a very serious, very sober title, The Anatomy of Antisemitism, a search into the spiritual roots of antisemitism. So by definition, it won't be a very entertaining evening. But I think just to loosen up the moment, I'll just share with you a quick joke. Some of you heard of it from some of the tapes, but it relates to suffering, and of course, that is of course the story of anti-Semitism. In case you didn't realize, I cover up my Brooklyn accent very well. And in London, actually, where I am born, if you go further south, the accent changes, and the farmers who live in the rural area over there, you could overhear a conversation that might go something like this. One farmer speaking to another British farmer and says, "You know something? I won $1 million. Oh, that'd be good. No, that'd be bad. I spent it all. Oh, that'd be bad. No, that'd be good. I bought myself an aeroplane. Oh, that'd be good. No, that'd be bad. It blew up in midair. Oh, that'd be bad. No, that'd be good. I have my parachute. Oh, that'd be good. No, that'd be bad. I forgot my parachute. Oh, that'd be bad. No, that'd be good. There was a haystack below. Oh, that'd be good. No, that'd be bad. There was a pitchfork sticking out the haystack. Oh, that'd be bad. No, that'd be good. I missed the pitchfork. Oh, that'd be good. No, that'd be bad. I missed the haystack. Oh, that'd be bad. No, that'd be good. I fell into an open grave. Oh, that'd be good. No, that'd be bad. The funeral people were filling it in. Oh, that'd be bad. No, that'd be good. I told them I was still alive. Oh, that'd be good. No, that'd be bad. They wouldn't believe me. Anyway, the story of Jewish history is saturated with suffering, saturated with blood. This evening's talk is not about finding meaning in what we went through. The question we're going to relate to is totally different. Imagine after looking back on our lives, on the major challenges that we went through, whether it was marriage, raising kids, an ugly divorce, some career changes which hurt to the core, medical setback, financial setback, whatever was the negative of the story of our life. Imagine, in the space of 1 hour, speaking to, having an interview with God. And he would somehow access all the spiritual roots of the why and the meaning of what I went through. So that as I walk out of my 1 hour session, my 1 hour interview with the Creator, not only am I satisfied that I understand why this happened to me, but I actually sign the bottom line saying, I agree with the perfection of your calculation in everything that happened in my life. What we're going to look at today is an issue which is complex and has successfully perplexed Jewish historians and secular historians who have failed until today to find a satisfying answer to the why and the whys of antisemitism. There are at least four items that we are going to identify tonight that distinguish antisemitism on a completely different league to any other hatred that any other people, race, culture, nation has experienced. And when we've completed identifying those four items and looked at the words of some of the greatest historians and the greatest writers and philosophers in history of mankind and how they were baffled by the why are the Jews so singled out for persecution? It makes no sense. There's no rationale that is satisfying to an intellectually honest mind. We're going to ask ourselves, let's have a quick interview with the Creator. And ask Him, please show us your comments on anti-Semitism before it even happened, so that we can hopefully identify the, so to speak, spiritual root cause, and then perhaps walk out with a different message of its purpose and the why of its universality, its totally irrational, its longevity, the why of all the 4 points that we're now about to identify of how anti-Semitism has baffled and perplexed us for thousands of years. There are libraries. There are days like today, Yom HaShoah, to memorialize events in our history that are sad, tragic, but we need satisfying answers. Where are we going to look? I would say that if we don't consult God, I'm going to tell you up front, there is no satisfying solution to the perplexity of anti-Semitism. And we're going to look now at the analysis that historians have put forward, researchers of anti-Semitism. What fruits has their research borne? Let's look at these four qualities that make anti-Semitism, the hatred of the Jew, completely different to any other hatred. Number one, it's universality. Every nation, almost, in history has had its go at the Jewish people. Where is there a communication between cultures and nations across time that they have an unwritten policy or agreement that the Jew, wherever he or she is, as an individual, as a community, as a nation, should have experienced, and we're going to see in a few moments, the long lists of expulsions, pogroms, holocausts, butchering, forced conversions, inquisitions, crusades. Where do we understand the uniting agreement between nations throughout history, the universality of anti-Semitism? It's unique. It stands out completely from any other hatred of another nation. Its longevity, ever since we've been a nation, and we can identify that exact moment, which we will see at the end of the presentation, occurred at Mount Sinai. The moment we became a nation is the moment that anti-Semitism, so to speak, descended to this world. We're going to look at that. Its longevity, the Babylonian Empire, the Persian Empire, the Greek Empire, the Roman Empire. Every empire tried to either persecute or destroy us. In this century alone, this past century alone, we've seen three empires come and go. The Third Reich, communism, and forgive me, I have to admit, the British Empire. They've come and gone. But you know something? The Jewish people have suffered at the hands of all three. And we're still here. That's something we're also going to look at. But the longevity, how anti-Semitism has managed to last for so long, irrational, makes no sense. Number three, the intensity of the hatred. Now I understand if you don't like someone, it's part of human nature to dislike people who are not like you. That's history of mankind is full of hatred for people that are different. So there's a discrimination. It's harder to get a job, harder to get to high points in society. But gassing, inquisitions, throwing into mass drowning, into Nile. The intensity of the hatred of anti-Semitism goes way beyond the norm of normal discrimination. And lastly, the irrationality of anti-Semitism. These are the 4 points we're going to look through, and then we're going to turn to prophecy. And we'll define prophecy very carefully, because it's unique to Judaism. There is no other religion, inverted commas, there's no other religion that even dared make a prophecy. The one that did, which is Christianity, we may have a moment to quickly look at that and understand how risky it is to make a prophecy. Because, of course, if you're prophesying for the future, whose credibility are you putting on the line? Not just the mouth of the prophet, but if he's speaking in the name of the Creator, can he take a risk on being 99% sure that the event will happen? Or does he have to be absolutely certain, without the slightest trace of doubt, that this event will happen? But what if that prophecy is projected into hundreds or thousands of years? Is that rational? That's not rational. Is that a risk? That's a great risk. And if you're putting God and the holy book of the Torah, the Old Testament as is known in society, if you're going to put the Old Testament, the five books of Moses, on the line, the most sold book in history, the most printed book in history, you better be certain that your prophecy is accurate. So we're going to ask ourselves, has anti-Semitism been prophesied? And if so, what is the exact description? And then we can ask the amazing question, this book written 3,311 years, and 48 weeks ago, when we look at the prophecies in this book, we sitting in this room over 3,000 years later will have the awesome privilege of asking the simple question, did it happen? Did it come true? And if it came true, what rational conclusion are we forced to come to based on the fact that you have to be insane to make these prophecies unless you're absolutely certain that you're not making them on your own volition, on your own intellectual research or projection? It's a reflection of the will of the one that controls destiny of mankind, the unfolding of the history of creation, and thus in control of nature, in control of historical events. We're going to look at that. And then we'll come to the final conclusions. What was in the mind of some of the greatest anti-Semites when they put to writing their intent on destroying the Jewish people? We'll read Voltaire, Hitler, Haman, and ask ourselves, is there a pattern? What happened over here? What is the war of anti-Semitism really about? Who is against who? Let's look at the universality of the Jewish people. Sometimes we have this on an overhead projector. Tonight I'm just going to give it to you. I'm going to list very briefly the universality of the discrimination, anti-Semitism, hatred, butchering, murdering of men, women, children, elderly and young, throughout history. And I'm going to read to you from the book Tradition and Crisis, published by Shulchan Books in 1961, a partial listing of the year and place where Jewish communities were expelled from their country. In the year 250, we were expelled from Carthage. 415, Alexandria. 554, Clement in France. 561, Eustace in France. 612, Visigoth in Spain. 642, Visigothic Empire, 855, Italy, 876, Sens, 1012, Mayence, 1181, France, 1290, England, 1306, France, 1348, Switzerland, 1348, Alsace, 1349, Hungary, 1388, Strasbourg, 1394, Germany, 1394, France, 1422, Austria, 1424, Fritzbergen, Zurich, 1426, Cologne, 1432, Savory, 1438, Mainz, 1439, Augsburg, 1456, Bavaria, 1453, you're writing fast enough? Okay. Franconia, 1453, Breslau, 1454, Würzburg, 1485, Vicenza, Italy, 1492, Spain, 1495, Lithuania, 1497, Portugal, we're one third through, 1499, Germany, 1514, Strasbourg, 1519, Wessenberg, 1514, Naples, have I made my point? 1542, Bohemia, 1550, Genoa, 1551, Bavaria, 1555, Pissarro, 1559, Austria, some of these countries we don't even know the names anymore, 1561, Prague, 1567, Würzburg, 1569, Papal States, 1571, Brandenburg, 1582, Netherlands, 1593, Brunswick, Austria, goes on and on and on and on, Frankfurt, Worms, Kiev, Ukraine, Hamburg, Little Russia, Lithuania, Vienna, Sandomir, Russia, Little Russia, Bohemia, Livonia, Moravia, we're up to 1753, Lithuania, 1761, you're hearing some of these names more than once. 1772, Pale of Settlement, Russia, 1775, Warsaw, 1789, Alsace, we had that already in France. 1804, Russian villages. 1808, Russian countryside. 1815, Lubeck and Bremen. 1815, Franconia, Swabia and Bavaria. 1820, Brems. 1843, Prussia, Russian, Austrian border. 1862, American territory under General Grant's jurisdiction. 1866, Galitz, Romania. 1919, Bavaria. 1938-45, Nazi-controlled areas. 1948, Arab lands. Universality. Does it make sense? Who was in agreement amongst all the nations that the Jews should be a constant and consistent target for expulsion? In fact, secular historians have identified that over the history of the Jewish people in exile for the last 2,000 years, when you statistically analyze how many years the average Jewish community were in one place, and you take into account the number of expulsions, this is the conclusion. When we scan the diaspora of Jewry over the entire globe and throughout the entire civilized world, we are surprised to see that this nation, which is almost the most ancient in the world, is in truth the youngest nation in the world in terms of the land under its feet and the sky above its head. As a result of the relentless persecutions and forced expulsions, most Jews are but recent newcomers to their respective lands of residence. 90% of the Jewish people have lived in their new homes for no more than 50 or 60 years. The Jewish people are dispersed throughout over 100 lands on all five continents. Universality. You know, it's interesting. How many people here in this room have been to Caesarea in Israel? Remember the ruins there? Right? You probably recall an Israeli tourist guide, probably without a yarmulke. I'm just saying that as an observation, not an evaluation. And he's standing there, and in front of you there might be a group of people from Sweden. Maybe behind you is a group from Germany. Another one from America. France. And what is he doing? This guide is showing over here, buried the Syrians, over here the Persians. You see this level over here in Jericho, if you've ever been to Jericho, 9 times it was destroyed and rebuilt and destroyed. The Greeks, the Babylonians, the Romans. Who is giving the guide the tour to whom? Think about it. Our enemies over here are buried here. This enemy who tried to destroy us is buried over here. Who's giving the tour? We're still here. And they're buried. Interesting. Does that make sense? Dispersed throughout the diaspora, over 100 countries in 5 continents, and we're back in Palestine, the promised land, in 1948. And now we're giving guided tours to other countries that tried to destroy us on our own homeland. the miracle of Jewish survival, which is a presentation in of its own right, is something which historians, writers throughout history have noted. And I will share with you two quotes, very famous, some of you might even know them by heart by now. And one is an essay written by no less than Mark Twain, entitled Concerning the Jews. It was written by Harper's Press, published by Harper's Press in 1899, and is part of his book, The Complete Essays of Mark Twain, page 249. If the statistics are right, the Jews constitute but 1% of the human race, and today it's a little bit less than 1%. It suggests a nebulous dim puff of stardust lost in the blaze of the Milky Way. Properly, the Jew ought hardly to be heard of, but he is heard of, has always been heard of. He is as prominent on the planet as any other people, and his commercial importance is extravagantly out of proportion to the smallness of his bulk. His contribution to the world's list of great names in literature, science, art, music, finance, medicine, abstruse learning are also a way out of proportion to the weakness of his numbers. He has made a marvelous flight in this world, in all the ages, and has done it with his hands tied behind his back. He could be vain of himself and be excused for it. The Egyptians, the Babylonian, the Persian, they all rose, filled the planet with sound and splendor, then faded to dream stuff and passed away. The Greek and the Roman followed and made a vast noise, and they are gone. Other peoples have sprung up and held their torch high for a time, but it burned out. And they sit in twilight now or have vanished completely. The Jew saw them all, beat them all, and is now what he always was, exhibiting no decadence, no infirmities of age, no weakening of his parts, no slowing of his energies, no dulling of his alert and aggressive mind. All things are mortal, but the Jew. All other forces pass, but he remains. What is the secret of his immortality? Mark Twain's own words. Leo Tolstoy. What is a Jew? This question is not as odd as it seems. Let us see what kind of peculiar creature the Jew is, which all the rulers and all the nations have together and separately abused and molested, oppressed and persecuted, trampled and butchered and burned and hanged, and in spite of all this, is yet alive. What is a Jew who has never allowed himself to be led astray by all the earthly possessions which his oppressors and persecutors constantly offered him in order that he should change his faith and forsake his own Jewish religion? And now Leo Tolstoy answers his own question. The Jew is that sacred being who has brought down from heaven the everlasting fire and has illuminated with it the entire world. He is the religious source, spring and fountain, out of which all the rest of the peoples have drawn their beliefs and their religions. The Jew is the emblem of eternity. He, whom neither slaughter nor torture of thousands of years could destroy. He whom neither fire nor sword nor inquisition was able to wipe off the face of the earth. He who was the first to produce the oracles of God. He who has been for so long the guardian of prophecy, and who has transmitted it to the rest of the world. Such a nation cannot be destroyed. The Jew is as everlasting as eternity itself. Written in 1908. One of our greatest rabbis of recent times, the last two centuries ago, Rabbi Yaakov Emden, made the following observation. He lived in 1695, sorry, to 1776. Many have tried to injure us but they were not able to destroy us or wipe us out. While all the great ancient civilizations have disappeared and been forgotten, the nation of Israel, who clings to God, is alive today. What will the wise historian answer when he examines this phenomena without prejudice? Was this all purely by chance? By my soul, I contemplated these great wonders of our continued survival, and as I did, they took on greater significance than all the miracles and wonders that God performed for our fathers in Egypt, in the desert, and when they entered the land of Israel. And the longer this exile extends, the miracle of Jewish existence becomes more obvious to make known God's mastery and supervision over nature and history. Unquote. His point is, and this is part of the conclusion up front for those of you who've had a long week already, can nod off after this part of the conclusion, the purpose of Jewish survival amidst the greatest persecution and adversity, expulsions, mass communities being massacred and destroyed, the purpose underlying our continued existence is that we give testimony to the promise that when God gave us the mission to be a light unto nations, we have to remain here in order to testify that that is a promise that can never be broken, no matter what we go through. Let us look at the intensity of the hatred. It wasn't enough just to be prejudiced. It's not a question of just discrimination against employment, rejection from universities and schools. We've been through that as well. Human nature throughout history has demonstrated people don't like others who are not like themselves. That would not be a surprise unto itself. But the intensity of anti-Semitism goes beyond all other descriptions of hatred. I want to quote to you from Voltaire. Voltaire has been described as the guru of Hitler, the one who inspired him. And I share with you from the writings of Voltaire, who lived in 1694 to 1778. He was one of the most powerful advocates of enlightenment. And yet, when you look carefully at his writings, his view of where the Jew belongs is unapologetic. "We find in Jews," he wrote, "only an ignorant and barbarous people who have long united the most sordid avarice with the most detestable superstition and the most invincible hatred for every people by whom they are tolerated and enriched." And he made one concession. "Still," he added, "we ought not to burn them." Continues. This is a prediction he made about the future. "When the society of man is perfected, the number of Jews will necessarily diminish. The rich among them are already beginning to detest their superstitions. There will be no more than the lot of a people without arts and laws, who no longer able to enrich themselves through our negligence, will no longer be able to sustain a separate society, and who, ignorant even of their own books, will assimilate amongst the scum of other peoples." I will share with you the famous German writer Dominicus Hermann Epiphanes. Very famous. 1833, let me quote to you the following. "After contemplating several alternatives for making the world, Judenrein, free of Jews, he concluded, the total extermination of Jewry would be incomparably easier. Jews can be turned into tallow candles, iron medals, or pretty milk-white glasses. A competition in the field of economics would be announced, whose subject would be, according to which principles, the total massacre of Jewry could be used to improve the soil. Hitler, quoted verbatim by Hermann Rauschning in the book The Voice of Destruction, by G.P. Putnam Press, New York, page 8 to 238. And these are excerpts, I'm quoting just one, from his Rauschning's intimate conversations with Hitler during the early years of the war. "Yes, we are barbarians. It is an honorable title to us. The Jews have inflicted two wounds on mankind. Circumcision on its body and a conscience on its soul. They are degrading suffering caused by the false vision." Sorry, I missed the line. "They are Jewish inventions, a conscience on the soul and circumcision. I am freeing humanity from the shackles of the soul." In other words, by destroying the Jew, you take away a conscience from the mind of mankind. "I am freeing humanity from the shackles of a soul, from the degrading suffering caused by the false vision called conscience and ethics. The struggle for world domination will be fought entirely between us, between the Germans and the Jews. All else is facade and illusion." All else is facade and illusion. Is it any surprise that in the dying hours of World War II, when the much needed supplies and provisions desperately should have been sent to the front lines of the Germans defending their retreating from the Allies, is it any surprise when requests came to Hitler to reroute the trains that are taking Jews to Auschwitz and Buchenwald, Dachau, and reroute the tracks to take the much needed troops and supplies to the German defense, Hitler's answer was, "The war against the Jews must go on. Everything else is a facade, an illusion." Anti-Semitism, the way he's describing it, is a deliberate attempt to remove the Jew from the world because the Jew represents morality, ethics, a conscience to the rest of the world. We talk about the intensity of persecution. There's no time to go through the full list. I'm going to share with you a partial list of the blood libels, the mass murders, the Inquisition, anti-Semitic outbreaks, expulsions, from 1096 right down to this last century. The first Christian crusades, decrees of mass sanctification of God's name, crisis of German Kehilot of communities, first blood libel in Norwich in England, 1144, 1147, Arab pogroms in Muslim Spain, 1146-49, second Christian crusades, 1181, rioting against Viennese Jews, 1182, expulsion of French Jewry, goes on and on and on, rioting against Jews of Frankfurt, pogroms against Jews of Erfurt, rioting against Jews of Mecklenburg, blood libel in Mecklenburg and Breslau, rioting and forced conversion in the Kingdom of Lyon, blood libels, many tortured and burned, destruction of entire communities, more than 3,000, hundreds forced to convert, ban on the Talmud, burning of the Talmud, Austrian Jews imprisoned, property stolen, Jews converted, burned or cruelly expelled. False accusations throughout history. 13 Jews in Persia today. Has the world changed that much? We go through it. Jewish blood is cheap. Who really cares? The church apologizes to the survivors, or to those who are already victims? What does it count? Let's look at the irrationality of anti-Semitism. How many of us read or saw the play or the film version of William Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice? I guess we're all familiar with the basic storyline. You have here portrayed a beautiful example of a kind-hearted, merciful Jewish heart. No, not at all. Now, where did William Shakespeare get the idea to give the impression of a Jew, which largely because of this play, till today in English dictionaries, if you look up Jew, the definition is miser, heartless, merciless. We're a byword. Where did William Shakespeare have an encounter with perhaps a Jewish moneylender that he couldn't afford to pay back a loan that he took from this Jew? And now he writes a play about how cruel Jewish moneylenders are. What encounter did he have? And you know something? What do we discover? Just from a point of view of simple observation. No evaluation. When did William Shakespeare die? 1613. Interesting. Why is that interesting? Because Jews were expelled from England in 1292. And we didn't return till 40 years after Shakespeare was buried in the ground under the protectorate of Oliver Cromwell. Where did William Shakespeare get the idea to portray us as so bloodthirsty, so merciless, heartless, so vengeful? Let me share with you Lloyd George. He made the following statement. British Prime Minister. Of all the extreme fanaticism that plays havoc in man's nature, there is none as irrational as anti-Semitism. The Jews cannot vindicate themselves in the eyes of these fanatics. If the Jews are rich, they are the victims of theft and extortion. If they are poor, they are victims of ridicule. If they take sides in a war, it is because they wish to gain vantage from the spilling of non-Jewish blood. If they espouse peace, it is because they are scared and anxious by nature or traitors to their country. If the Jew dwells in a foreign land, he is persecuted and expelled. If he wishes to return to his own land, he is prevented from doing so. English Cardinal Manning. The imperishable people which with an inextinguishable life and immutable traditions and faith in God and in the laws of God, scattered as it is all over the world, passed through the fires unscathed, trampled into the dust and yet never combining with the dust into which it was trampled, live still a witness and a warning to us all. They're baffled. We're still here. There's no rationale behind the persecution. It makes no sense. Unless there's a divine plan that ordains the unfolding in history. What is that about? Wherever we want to pinpoint persecution, it comes out in the most ridiculous, irrational explanations. The Black Plague. We drank from the same wells as our Christian and Gentile victims of the bubonic plague. And yet, after this plague had taken a toll of about one third of the entire Europe, who was blamed for having poisoned the wells with vermin? The Jews drank from the same wells. Anti-Semitism, it's universal. We find it irrational. Its longevity has lasted in every culture, empire, time zone, every age. Makes no sense. What is the real root of anti-Semitism? I'm going to share one, two more quick quotes before we look at God's version, his perspective. Lord Wilson, chairman of the British Authors Association, when visiting Israel in 1976, was interviewed by Israeli press following the tragic butchering of 13 Jews on an El Al plane. And in response to that hijack, the Israeli Air Force opened fire on an airport where the plane was hijacked, 13 planes that were unmanned. And the entire international media criticized the Israeli state and Jews internationally. And one comment made was, "We've heard of an eye for an eye, but 13 eyes for one?" One minute. 13 Jews, their blood is spilled. 13 Jews who could have raised families and built generations after them, gone. 13 planes, metal, destroyed. This is your logic? This is rational? Lord Wilson was asked to comment on this episode. And he was asked the following question. Why is it that international media consistently condemn Israel for every act of defense or retaliation? And these are his words. "You seem to miss the message," he said, "that the Gentile world has been demonstrating through its hard line judgment of Jews and today's Israel's actions. We expect from the Jew a higher moral standard than we do from ourselves." What Lord George Wilson was saying is not necessarily to be misunderstood as really anti-Semitic. He's simply saying that when a Gentile sees a Jew commit a crime, even in defense, we hold the Jew to a much higher standard. If a Gentile is caught for crimes against the government, or fraud, or laundering drugs, it might get to one of the pages in the newspaper. But a Jew? A religious Jew? Whoa! That's news! That's shocking! There's a certain compliment, and I'm not by any means defending over here, there's a certain compliment in the outrage that the Gentile world has when they report a Jew, secular or religious, found committing a crime. Mrs. Margaret Thatcher, when she was Prime Minister of England, on July the 14th, 1989, she was at a press conference and she was asked the following question. That same day, July 14th, France was celebrating its 200th anniversary of the French Revolution since the storming of Bastille. And when she was asked to comment on the celebrations going on in France for the enlightenment that the French Revolution brought, her answer was the following. "I don't know whether French people have the right to take credit for having brought to the world brotherhood, freedom, and equality. For if I am not mistaken, it was the Jewish people who gave the world brotherhood, freedom, and equality some 3,000 years prior to the French Revolution." What we see is that those who've studied carefully the history of the Jewish people with some intellectual honesty understand that the Jew is held to a different standard. Why? When we ask ourselves, what is the most unique distinction that separates us from all the other nations in the history of our people? It's one event. The event of Mount Sinai. When we became a nation. The event that we just celebrated, following the Exodus, whose purpose was that we would arrive at Mount Sinai and receive from the one power, Creator, who was responsible for the Exodus, His instructions for us to live and give to mankind. And in the description that Moses gives, reminding us of this event, he includes a number of prophecies, including that of expulsion, dispersion, persecution. And I want to share with you, as we now switch into God's perspective of anti-Semitism, to get the full context of the prophecies that were given. And I want us to ask the question, did they happen? What's the obvious risk in making a prophecy? The national broadcaster can give a local prediction of the weather over the next day or two or three. But you're not going to call him a prophet if he says there's going to be 6 inches of snow on December 31st in the year 2500. Why won't you call him a prophet if indeed it snows 6 inches in New York on December 31st, the year 2500? That's a 500-year projection. That's pretty neat. Wait a minute. December 31st is the winter. New York? That's not unusual. That's not irrational. Irrational predictions are nowhere even close to prophecy. We who invented prophecy created the criteria that true prophecy is totally irrational. It has to be irrational in order for us to know that it's real prophecy and not a human being who made it up on their own. Vision or trance or imagined communication with a higher source. Jewish prophecy has to be detailed and irrational. Because then, in the actual prophecy is the evidence that you and I in the future can determine, was it real? Did it happen? And we look at Deuteronomy chapter 4, verses 26 onwards, and we see the most extraordinary risk that Moses takes. And to get the context of this, we're close to the end of the Jewish story of the wanderings in the desert, and we're about to enter the promised land. That was a prophecy in and of itself, given in Genesis chapter 15 to Abraham. And now we're on the border, Transjordan, about to enter the land, and Moses starts to give us a preview of what's to come. Not very encouraging. And he says the following: I testify against you today, et hashamayim ve'et haaretz, the heavens and the earth, ki avoy tovedun maher me'al haaretz, you're going to quickly perish from the land, asher atem ovrim et hayarden shama l'rishta, the land you're about to inherit, you're about to cross over the Jordan River and inherit, you're not going to be there for very long. Lai ta'arichun yamim aleha, you're not going to be there for many days, ki yishamet tishamedun, you'll perish from there. Wait a minute, Moses! You know, we've been wandering 40 years, we're just about to enter the promised land, and already you're telling us we're not going to be there for long. Prophecy number one. Obvious risk. Moses, you're not even coming with us. How are you going to guarantee that we're going to remain there for a short while? The Hefetz Hashem, and God will scatter etchem, you, ba'amim, amongst the nations. V'nish'artem, so that's prophecy number two, we're going to be scattered amongst the nations. To be scattered amongst nations, we have to be able to identify that we're still the same people after we were scattered. Because usually, the Romans, when they divide and conquer, the people can't identify their identity after 2-3 generations. Language, culture, different land, all dissipated. assimilated, eliminated. Moses, you say we're going to be scattered amongst the nations. How are we going to retain our identity? You're not coming with us. That's prophecy number two. Prophecy number three. V'nish'artem, you will remain, matei mispar, small in number. Moses, are you giving out birth control? I mean, are we into small families? I mean, how do you guarantee that the Jewish people will remain small in number while we're scattered amongst all the nations? V'nish'artem matei mispar b'goyim, you will remain small in number amongst the nations. Asher yinahig Hashem, where God is driving etchem, you, shama, there. God is behind this, not finished. And there you will serve other gods, and from there you will request, ubikashtem et Hashem elokecha, you will find him, umatzata, ki tirshun b'chol levavcha, you're going to search him for, with all your heart, with all your soul. B'chol levavcha, b'chol nafshcha. But tzalecha umatzaucha, all these things, kol ha'dvarim meir, all these things, b'acharis yamim, will find you in the end of days. We've got our own calendar. Our calendar is not the year 2000. Our calendar is the year 5760. According to our calendar, it's a 6,000 year calendar, after which the Messiah has to come. That's the expiration date. Hopefully we'll deserve him on our own before that time, but that's our claim. So I'm not saying that to convince anyone. I'm just saying that when he says B'acharit HaYamim, at the end of days, if our calendar is 5,760 and it's a 6,000 year calendar, we're in the last fraction. We're at close to sundown on Friday afternoon as Shabbos, as the Sabbath enters. V'shavta, and you will return ad Hashem Elokecha till your God. V'shamata b'kol, and you will listen to him. Look at those prophecies so far. Did they come true? We entered the land. Check it off. Did we remain there? No. Were we expelled, thrown out? Yes. Babylonian and Roman conquest. Were we scattered throughout the nations? Absolutely. On 100 countries and 4-5 continents. Did we remain small in number? According to historical, secular historians, at the time of the first census of the Roman Empire, the Jewish people were 9%, about 3 million. And approximately the same time, 200 AD, the Chinese in China were about 3 million. How many Chinese are there today? Approximately 1.2 billion, take a few million. How many Jews are there? 14, 15, 16? What happened? Yeah, no, persecution, expulsions, conversions. But Moses, how do you guarantee that we'll remain less than 1% of the human race? We're here today, we can ask ourselves, did it happen? But that's not all. The root of antisemitism is in the next words. Says Moses, Ki sha'al na. What does sha'al mean? Ask. What does na mean? Please. Moses speaks to the Jewish people and says, Ki sha'al na. Please ask the following question. Liyamim rishonim. About the days that came before you. Asher hayu lefanecha. The days that came before you. Lemin hayayim. From the day Asher bar Elokim Adam. From the day God created man, al ha'aretz, on earth, ulemikze ha'shamayim v'ad keitze ha'shamayim, from one end of the universe till the other, haniya kadava ha'gadol hazeh, was there ever an event as great as this? O hanishma kamohu, or did you ever hear anyone else say an event happened like this? And what is that event? Hashama'am kol Elokim, and nation heard the voice of God, midabe mitoich ha'esh, speaking from the fire, kasher shamata, like you heard, vayichi, and you lived through it. Moses is telling us that the one event that distinguishes the Jew from every other nation is Mount Sinai. That we heard God speak to us. Now when I used to teach comparative religion in YU, it's interesting. You can look up a dictionary of all religions in the history of mankind, how many said that God spoke to a whole nation?
One.
And every other that has any claim whatsoever that there was a divine communication is based on individual prophecy. God spoke to me and appointed me the prophet. Whether it's Muhammad from behind the mountain, how many people were there when God spoke to him and appointed him the new prophet? No one! How many people were there when Jesus got out of his grave? Of the 7 different accounts in the New Testament, not one account says that there were people standing by the gravesite and saw him get out. If you're going to start a religion, don't start one, but if you know someone who wants to start a religion, what's a greater claim? What's the obvious, better, superior claim? That God spoke to me personally last night? And therefore I'm asking you to believe in me and my experience. Or, I was in Madison Square Garden last night. And in front of 20,000 people, the roof opened up. And a giant hand came down and pointed its finger at me and said, "You are my chosen prophet on earth to give my instructions to mankind." And in front of 20,000 people who experienced it with me, they saw God speak to me. Which is the most obvious, more compelling claim to make if you want to start a religion. So why didn't anyone else think of this claim? And the answer is, very powerful rationale. You cannot make a claim of a historical event that happened to many people and falsify it. It's impossible. Why? Because you can verify it. How do we know General Custer lived? How do we know George Washington lived? How do we know there was a signing of the Magna Carta? How do we know any historical event to be true? Because there were people who were living witnesses who encountered, who were there. We were there, 3 million of us, at Mount Sinai. We were there in Egypt. And it's not the position tonight to show all the archaeological findings that clearly identify Israel, the land of Israel, is the richest land for this new science of archaeology. That there's not one account in the Bible that has yet to be contested based on the findings under the ground of artifacts, papyri, that indicate the events were true, including the Exodus. So we've gotten the most powerful argument. Witnesses. We experienced God. Says the Talmud, the day we stood at Sinai, hatred for the Jew came into the world. And that's why it's called Sinai. Sinai is almost the same language as Sinah. Sinah means hatred. Why is it called Sinai? Because hatred came to the world for the Jew. Because when we stood at Sinai, we received the instructions of morality, a conscience, ethics, how to behave, how to take care of the poor, the widow. Love your neighbor as yourself is not the New Testament. It was preceded only about 1,000 years before, in Leviticus chapter 19, this week's reading. Taking care of the orphan, the widow, the poor, charity, kindness, these are all Jewish inventions. The Decalogue, honor parents, it's all Jewish. English laws based on Roman laws, based on Talmudical law. The contribution of the Jewish people to the world started at Sinai as a nation representing morality, ethic. In a world without God, there are no rules. Who's to say that you and I have a right to kill a mosquito if there's no God to say what's right or wrong? Who permits taking a canister and spraying a mosquito to death? Who says that's okay? Who says that's ethically moral? If there's no God, anything's permitted. If there's no God that dictates an absolute right and wrong, who's to say that a certain people who are the vermin and rats of mankind are the poison of the world? Who says there's anything wrong in gassing them? The battle of anti-Semitism is between God or no God. Hitler put it, it's a battle between Germany and the Jews, because the Jews inflicted the wound of a conscience upon mankind. Remove the Jew, there's no conscience, no morality, you can do what you want. 63% of the SS officers standing on trial at the Nuremberg trials held PhDs. Culture, information is not synonymous to morality. In 1938, when asked what is the reason that Germany banned ritual slaughter, shechita, kosher slaughtering, the answer was cruelty to animals. Oh, cruelty to animals. Have a conscience. Interesting. Dostoevsky, a Russian philosopher and author, in 1877 made the following statement. In a world without God, all is permitted. If there's a world with no design, no purpose, who's the authority that declares what's right and wrong? Comes along Mount Sinai, changes all that. The Jewish people were singled out. Asher bachar banu mikol amim. We were chosen from all other nations to carry the light of clarity on all moral issues of conscience and ethic. Yes, we are held to a higher standard because we stood at Sinai. And that's when sinner, that's when hatred came to the world, because we stand for God's conscience in man, in mankind's conscience. Anti-Semitism is the attempt to rid man of the shackles of discipline and the freedom to be able to do, live, say, act in any which way a human being wants in order to fulfill their personal agendas. It's interesting to note that whenever a Jew was exiled, the Babylonian exile, Persian exile, Greek exile, Roman exile, we were always exiled to the greatest and most glorified culture of the time. Says God, my precious Jewish child, live and see the Egyptians in their moral depravity before I give you the divine instructions at Mount Sinai. Live in Babylon, the most powerful, most glorified empire, and see its value for life. Live under the Persian rule and experience Haman, and his decree to destroy you all with the full consent of the king and his subjects. Live under the rule of the Romans, who will conquer and divide, scatter you to the furthest corners of its empire, and witness the most powerful empire in all its full glory of barbarism, violent gladiator entertainment. Live amongst the Christian world and taste the religion of love and mercy, while entire communities are butchered by the Crusaders, false blood libels, inquisitions, forced conversions. Experience the golden age of Spain, culture, art, and the heat of the Inquisition, burning of Jewish flesh with Jewish scrolls of the Torah. Live in Tsarist Russia, or better still, a superior improvement, communism, the communist regime, and see the morality of a people without absolute morals, as they cut up children in the eyes of the parents with pogroms, destroy families and Jewish hamlets at the hands of the Cossacks, or try the highest culture of all, the pure Aryan race, as they bask in the glory of art and classical music while burning 6 million children, mothers, fathers, grandparents, sisters, brothers. The message is that culture, no matter how advanced, culture and morals are not synonymous. A world without God is capable of the worst crimes. I'll share with you a bumper sticker. A bumper sticker that appeared in 1973. It said, "Jews go home! We don't want Jews, we want oil." After the oil embargo, a number of states had this bumper. I see some people remember. And in a small Gazette Telegraph in Colorado, a certain William Aiken wrote in the following letter. And within 2 days, it was published in over 250 newspapers nationally. "Jews go home! Well now, this is nothing new. Never in the past have you ever taken this gentle suggestion to move on. But heaven forbid, suppose just this once you thought that this expression of a few sick people actually reflected the conviction of all the people in this wonderful land of ours, and all of you start to pack your bags and leave. Jews go home! We don't want Jews, we want oil! But before you leave, could you do me a favor? Would you leave behind your formula for the Jonas Salk vaccine? You wouldn't want to be so heartless to let our children contract polio, would you? And would you please leave your knack for government and politics and your power of persuasion, your literature and your good food? And would you please leave behind the secret of your desire to succeed? And please, have pity on us. Please show us the secret of how to develop such geniuses as Einstein and Steinmetz, and so many others who have helped us all. After all, we owe you a lot for the atomic bomb, most of our space research, and perhaps even for the fact that we are alive today, because instead, we could have been looking up from our chains and graves at Hitler, old but glad, driving slowly in our streets in one of our Cadillacs, had he succeeded in reaching the atom bomb and not us. On your way out, Jews, will you do me a favor? Will you drop by my house and pick me up too? I'm not sure I could live securely in a land where you are not to be found. For if ever you were to leave, love goes with you. Democracy goes with you. Morality goes with you. Everything I and my buddies fought for in World War II goes with you. Because God goes with you. Just pull up in front of my house. Slow down and honk me. Because I'm going with you too. Yours truly, William Aiken." The bottom line is that God prophesied events, including persecution, which I didn't even get into the full prophecies in chapter 28 in Deuteronomy and chapter 26 in Leviticus, prophesied events that are totally irrational, make no sense, defy all intellectual investigation, and has baffled and continues to perplex the greatest, deepest minds. But that's if there's no God in the picture. Because from his perspective, we have to exist. It's a promise that we are an eternal nation. And that our survival is the greatest miracle of all world history. and that in that miracle is the continued testimony that the Jewish people are here because we have the duty to continue being the light unto nations for ourselves, our spouse, our children, Jewish continuity, and as a shining, sterling example to the world around us. In 4 weeks' time, Memorial Day weekend, we have a seminar, the Gateway Seminar. There's some people in the audience who have experienced the Gateway Seminar. There are 13 lectures. The one you heard tonight doesn't even get onto the agenda. These 13 lectures, people have listened to and walked away saying, I got more of a Jewish education in this one weekend than all my Sunday schools combined of my entire lifetime. And the clarity I'm walking away with is giving me a stronger sense of my Jewish identity, where I'm coming from, where I'm going to, and what my responsibility and ability is to confidently transmit Jewish identity and values to my children, so that I can go to sleep at night saying, I'm doing what I can so that my grandchildren will be Jewish. I invite you to take full advantage of that weekend and get a deeper glimpse and appreciation and clarity of what it means to have stood at Mount Sinai and sit in this room today being able to check off all the events that were prophesied and say with a resounding yes, I have the confidence that I can transmit to my children the same clarity of conscience, ethic, morality that he and she needs, that they should be a light unto nations too. Thank you for your time.